Hello, and welcome to Tent Talks. I'm your host, Jesse Turner. After being a college access counselor for 7 years in a rural high school, I wanted to talk to rural leaders about their story, who they are, why they do what they do now, and how they feel like they can help. Justice Sarah Campbell joins us today, and I'm legally obligated to mention that I had permission to approach the bench and that my line of questionings was sustained. All right, puns aside, we discussed her small-town East Tennessee roots, how technology has impacted even the justice system, and how her dual degrees, a huge accomplishment in itself, has set her up for success in her current role as a Tennessee Supreme Court Justice. This is Tent Talks. I was born here and raised here, and I'll make my grave here, it's home. Tennessee. Today, we are here in a mobile studio in Nashville, Tennessee, and I would love to learn how to properly address you because I have you down as Justice Sarah Campbell. Is that what people call you in your normal day life, or is that only a work name?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think in the legal profession, certainly that's what most people call me. When I'm sitting on the bench, absolutely, that's what people call me. I probably get called that more than I would like just in my everyday life. But you may feel free to call me whatever you're comfortable with. Okay. I am comfortable with Sarah, and you are not a lawyer, and you are not appearing before me.
Okay, so. That's wonderful, because I'm very nervous when I approach the bench. I have a very funny story of my only time in traffic court. I walked past the bench, and my very sweet lawyer friend at the time kind of grabbed me and told the judge, he said, "See, he doesn't know how this works. He thought you meant approach the front bench. He's definitely not a criminal." So, that is wonderful. I can't imagine, though, that if I saw you outside of work that I wouldn't call you Justice Campbell, because I feel like that's one of those nicknames that friends like to call. It's like when your friend's a doctor and you're like, "Oh, this is Dr. Campbell, this is Dr. Jesse, this is Dr." Friends love to call each other the most fanciest of nicknames, you know, just to ride that a little bit. So
that can be the case. And it's funny too, I'm realizing this now that I'm about 2.5 years in, you know, the whatever your title is, justice or judge, at some point it just sort of becomes your first name. Yes. Like instead of people calling you Justice Campbell, they just say justice or
That's
judge,
right.
Which, you know, I certainly do. I'm just thinking of the judge for whom I clerked right out of law school. He's just judge. You know, I so rarely will say his last name, and I would never feel comfortable calling him anything else. So it's just judge. So that sort of, I think you evolve into that at some point, but it's fun to you to have just different parts of your life. You know, I still get to be Sarah a whole lot, you know, including I have 3 young kids. So
so they don't appreciate it all.
Well, no, and you know, and I'm just their mom. I also lose my name in that instance. I'm just, you know, their mom. I'm not, I don't even get called by my name very often in that context, but it's great. So good to have, I guess, different identities.
That's right. Well, I guess I will start by addressing you as Justice Campbell, but I would love to know more about Miss Sarah, and tell me about kind of, let's start at the beginning, about where you grew up and how that impacted who you are today.
Sure. So I was born in Campbell County, Tennessee, in La Follette. I'll go back just a little bit farther, though, because I think that kind of my family roots before that really influenced me as well. So my maternal grandparents lived in Union County, Tennessee, and they, along with a lot of residents of Union County during the 1930s, Great Depression, were relocated when the TVA, or when the TVA built Norris Dam and created the Norris Reservoir. So I think that really had a pretty big influence on me as I was growing up. You know, I think they had a great community in Union County. They had lived there for a long time. They were farmers, very tied to their land and their communities. And that was, of course, a very upsetting and difficult time for my family and for a lot of those families. So they moved. This was before my mother was born, but her oldest sister, my mom's one of seven, so her oldest sister was a young child at the time. They had to uproot and move, and a lot of those families ended up moving to Campbell County, which is pretty close to Union County. So I don't have family roots going back, you know, generations and generations in Campbell County, but that's because they had to relocate there.
And what was in Campbell County to relocate to? Like, what was there a promise of a job? Was there a promise of of something there?
I think it was primarily a promise of land. I mean, they were farmers, and mm-hmm. so, you know, they wanted to continue farming. And so it was both land. I think a lot of their neighbors and family members were also relocating to that area. You know, but because they were losing that community, I think a lot of those families did try to start over mm-hmm. within close proximity to family and neighbors. I mean, my maternal grandfather's brother had a farm right next door to his in Campbell County. And so I think they looked for a place where they could, spread out and still be together and still have some sense of community, even though they had lost a lot too.
Wow. And I was actually just in Union County visiting that area. That's one of our Ayers Foundation counties that we're in. So that was,
it's a beautiful place.
It is. The drive in, it was raining, and I'm not around the mountains very often. I'm from West Tennessee, and so we're very flat over there. So even through the rain, you could tell that it was just beautiful. Like, I don't know if that added to the ambiance of the area, but yeah, it was a beautiful area. So I imagine that was a heartbreaking move to make the way over to Campbell County from there. So that's
it was. And, you know, Campbell County ended up, I think, being a great place for them to start over though. So that's where my mother was born. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, she was one of seven. They farmed. They had a lot of other jobs in addition to farming, because it's pretty hard to eke out, you know, a living on farming alone for a lot of people. So, mm-hmm. They worked in factories, you know, they did a lot of odd jobs in addition to really hard farming, tobacco farming, and you know, raising a lot of crops and livestock just for their family, too. With seven kids, you can imagine that takes a lot to feed everyone and Absolutely. Keep them going. So so I was born in La Follette, lived right down the road from my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. And, you know, so I started life in a rural community in Tennessee, and just have so many great memories of my time there. I mean, we lived out in the country, we lived near family. It was a great community. And I went to elementary school at the local public elementary school, East La Follette. Mm-hmm. So I started out there, had wonderful teachers, some of whom I still hear of from time to time when I've been back to La Follette and Campbell County to speak a few times in my current position, which is always a treat. And when I was back recently, they actually mentioned that my kindergarten teacher, who I still have such fond memories of, I think was being honored. Mrs. Faulkner was her name, if she or any of her fans happen to be listening. So it's just always fun to see the impact that they've made. So when I was in the second grade, my family actually relocated to Indiana for just a few years. Mm-hmm. My dad worked for TRW Automotive, and at the time in Knoxville, and as we see so often in rural communities, sometimes the jobs are elsewhere. So even when we lived in La Follette, my father commuted about an hour each way to his job. And in Knoxville, that factory closed. He was an accountant. I should back up a little. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. But I was born in Campbell County. My dad is from Scott County, Tennessee. So just a neighbor of Campbell County.
Right.
Also a really rural area. His family had lived there for a long time. My dad was actually the first in his family to attend college. So he was the oldest of four boys. My paternal grandparents didn't have the opportunity to attend college. My grandfather was a World War II veteran and then worked on the railroad for many, many years. And he didn't even graduate from high school. My grandmother did graduate from high school, but, you know, they farmed, they worked primarily in manual labor. So my dad, I just have so much admiration and respect for him, because that's not an easy thing to be the first in your family to do that.
Isn't.
And it just wasn't very common in that community either. So he attended Tennessee Tech. He worked, you know, at a gas station in the summers during the breaks to save up. He would save enough to pay for one quarter and then, you know, work some during school and take out some loans. So he did it. He graduated with an accounting degree and really just opened so many doors for my family. So my mother did not have the opportunity to attend college. I mentioned she's one of seven kids. She was the next to youngest, and of her, you know, seven kids in that family, only the youngest actually got a college degree. And it was because by that time there were loans available. There were, you know, there were avenues to do that for a family that couldn't otherwise afford it. So we packed up, moved to Indiana for a few years because of my dad's job opportunities, and for the first time, I was not living in a rural area. It wasn't a bustling city by any means. We were in Lafayette, Indiana, near Purdue University, but it was certainly a lot different than I was used to. Had a great time there, but my family always wanted to come back to the South and to Tennessee in particular. So eventually, my dad had the opportunity to move back to Hawkins County. There was a TRW automotive plant in that town, so he was still employed by TRW and had the opportunity to come back and work in Rogersville in Hawkins County. So that was when I was in, let me see if I can get this right, I was just starting sixth grade, if I'm remembering correctly. So we moved to Rogersville, and that's where I really spent most of my formative years. I went to middle school and high school in Hawkins County. My parents still live there. My brother and his family live there. So that is home now is Nashville, where I live with my family. But I would say my second home is Rogersville.
Very nice. Very nice. And tell me, growing up, you get to see your dad as a first generation college graduate. How important in your household growing up was it that you attend college after high school?
It was very important. I mean, I just remember that sort of always being the expectation. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, that was because it had opened so many doors for my dad. That was probably always, you know, also because I have always been a little bit of a nerd and loved school. So, but, you know, I just don't remember it ever seeming like it wasn't an option to go to college. And that was, I'm very thankful to my parents for that they set that expectation for us and that goal for us and, you know, gave us the opportunities that we needed to be able to achieve that. So it wasn't only my family. I mean, I just remember that even from my elementary and middle and high school education, even though I was in, for most of that, I was in rural counties where a lot of students didn't go to college. I think the teachers were great about identifying students who, you know, academically should go, like absolutely, you know, should be thinking about that and helping them take steps to achieve that.
Very cool. Very cool. And tell me, so college was the expectation. And we hear that from first generation college students' children and saying, hey, like we kind of forged this path. Like we know that this is possible. And they see the potential in you to do it. But the jump from the expectation to go to school into law school is a huge jump. When did you know that law was the path?
It wasn't until I was probably a junior or senior in college. I wasn't one of these kids who knew from, you know, age five that she wanted to be a lawyer. That wasn't the case for me. It was sort of a gradual realization through the course of my educational career. But, you know, one of the reasons I think I didn't have that goal earlier is because I didn't see a lot of different professions. I did grow up in rural areas. I didn't have, you know, I didn't have family members who were, you know, who had earned professional degrees. I didn't personally know many lawyers, certainly not many female lawyers. So it just wasn't something that I aspired to early on. I think I thought of more, you know, like being a doctor. I mean, that's what I wanted to do for a long time until I took honors chemistry.
And it will separate.
It will.
That one in honors, any honors, high science. And then with my students that I always said that wanted to explore the medical field, I said, take AMP1 and you will know for sure if this is your path. And if you hate AMP1, it only gets worse from here.
Absolutely.
So I love to hear this though. So did you start college as pre-med? Did you think this is my route?
I did. And, you know, I should say too, I'm so grateful to have had the college experience that I did. I applied to a few different places, you know, including outside the state, including both public and private. And, you know, initially I thought I would love to get out of Tennessee. You know, I would love to do something a little different. But as things turned out, I mean, UT really offered me the best opportunity. There's so many wonderful scholarships available, not just at UT, but, you know, places across the state that I think make it possible for rural residents who might not, you know, who maybe can't afford to go to more elite universities to have a really high quality experience. So I was had a full tuition scholarship to UT. Wow. Dortch Oldham he's no longer with us, but he funded the scholarship, the Oldham scholarship. It was so unique. There was a cohort, you know, in each grade, and then the whole group of Oldham scholars every year would take a cultural trip together. So included in the scholarship was funding to just take a trip to experience both, you know, part of the country that we might not have seen before, but also the sorts of experiences that we needed exposure to.
Absolutely. That exposure for those rural students.
Right. It was phenomenal. And then it also included, it included money for study abroad. So it just opened so many unique opportunities for me and gave me a lot of flexibility to not be in debt so that I could think about law school.
Absolutely.
And maybe going somewhere for law school that would have seemed cost prohibitive, or, you know, that would have seemed inaccessible in some way.
I love the thought, though, of someone being so forward thinking of saying these students, there could be, you know, your odds are from at UT that you're dealing with rural students, and then being so forward thinking to think that the education is not enough. We need to expose them. So tell me, where did a graduate of Hawkins County, where did you get to go in college? For those exposure trips?
Sure. So we went to Boston, we went to San Francisco, we went to New York, and we went to Miami. So
that was fantastic. It was so many regions.
Yeah.
So many.
No, and every time, and it was so fun because every trip, you know, we were engaged in, you know, planning and and learning more about the city and learning more about, you know, the different experiences we could have there. So I think that actually probably contributed to the travel bug that I have today. I love to travel. I love planning trips. It's one of my favorite things to do. So I do attribute at least some of that that hobby and that love to those trips early in college. But and then in addition to that, you know, I was able to I studied in Spain. I backpacked in Europe. I have to mention, too, UT had this fabulous program called the Normandy Scholars Program that offered a whole interdisciplinary semester of study about World War II that culminated in a trip to France with Wow. World War II veterans. Was truly amazing. So that was not part of the Oldham Scholarship, but it was just another example of a terrific opportunity that allowed me, as a rural Tennessee graduate, high school graduate, to really broaden my horizons and just gain such a rich experience.
Wow. Well, as someone who got to see just wonderful places, the exposure, you know, you lived in a slightly larger place than what you started from, but then you moved back to rural. Looking at that from this perspective today, what are some of the things that you feel like are some of the most pressing challenges in rural communities? You know, it could be from where you were from, things that you saw growing up, or things that you experience now.
So I think the biggest challenge that rural communities face in our state is a lack of jobs. I know so many people who would have stayed if they had had the right sort of professional opportunities there, or who maybe did stay and as a result of that have been hindered in some way because they haven't had the flexibility to move for better job opportunities. You know, the pandemic brought with it so many challenges. You know, I do think that maybe one silver lining from that is that people do have more virtual work opportunities now. And I think that has been a real benefit for rural residents. I should say both opportunities for virtual education.
That's right.
And virtual job opportunities. Because I do think there are a lot of people who would love to be in a rural area. I mean, there's so many wonderful things about rural communities in terms of lifestyle and cost of living, but you know, you have to have job opportunities there too. So I am hopeful that these virtual opportunities might allow more people who would like to be in rural areas to be there, but also, you know, to maybe entice people who didn't grow up in that sort of place to consider it as a place to live and thrive.
Absolutely. It one of the things that I said about it was it kicked the door open to realize how beneficial high-speed internet can be in rural communities. One of the things we offer at the Ayers Entrepreneur Center, where our podcast studio is located, is 1 gigabyte download speeds of internet, high-speed internet, that's available all throughout the building. And, you know, as growing up in rural, I think of dial-up. I think of this, you know, super slow, you know, the AOL noises and all of that. And it's funny to think that high-speed internet is something that kids would think of as just, oh, I can stream faster, or I can play online, or I can do these things. But using that high-speed internet to open these doors for education and jobs that, you know, we could have a small office in Parsons, Tennessee, of any major corporation. They could have management there. They could have entry workers there. And because they have access to high-speed internet, they can literally set up a workstation and be this own department that is, you know, connected to a Nashville company, but is located in a small rural community. And so, you know, things like that, that kind of burst that door open because of COVID, because we realized high-speed internet was available. We needed it for, you know, Zoom that took off. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's those job opportunities that could be open the doors through virtual work. You know, I can't say that I love to work from home, but I have done it. And it's to think, though, that that is kind of like the entryway. You know, like that's kind of like the first innovation was, well, I can do this from home temporarily. And then for us to kind of pick up on that and say, well, if we can do this from home temporarily, what's to stop us from working down the street for a Fortune 500 company that's located in New York, but I'm in rural West Tennessee? And so that's, it is, I think we're just on that early side of it, of trying to see those benefits come through. So
you're right. And that's a really good point, that it's also about infrastructure, because, you know, high-speed internet, just that does bring, you're right, not only the virtual work opportunities, but makes it possible for, you know, perhaps larger corporations that would like to open offices in rural places, if they have the infrastructure they need, that's a lot more feasible.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about the year 2024. At the time of this recording, we're about halfway through it. What are some of you personally, what are some of your 2024 aspirations? These can be personal, these can be professional.
Within the past year, I guess this started in 2023, I became the chair of our Tennessee Supreme Court's Technology Oversight Committee. And that has been such a privilege to work in that area and to work alongside judges and court clerks from across the state to begin discussing some of the technology challenges that our judiciary faces. And as you might imagine, a lot of those challenges are most pressing in our rural counties. Tennessee does not yet have e-filing, so the ability to electronically file court documents across the state. Some of our counties have it, and most of those counties are more urban or at least suburban counties. Our rural counties are the ones that are lagging behind for the most part. I mean, there are exceptions to that, but many of the counties that do not yet have it are our rural counties. And so that's been a really fun project that I think brings together my current position and my just interest in seeing the judiciary writ large, you know, thrive and be as efficient as possible for our citizens. You know, with my rural roots, because I think to make that larger goal happen, like, we have to really focus on our rural counties and identify some ways to bring them along, you know, as the maybe more urban or suburban counties make strides in technology. So that is an exciting project that I will be working on, I think, for years to come. But we released a technology strategic plan this past year, and we're working toward implementing parts of that over the coming years. And that is really exciting for me, because I do think that it allows us to give more Tennesseans better access to the judiciary. And that's just so critical to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to access the justice system when they need it. So that is, I put that near the top of my list professionally, and I you know, lots of personal goals too, but you know, I do have young kids, as I mentioned. They're all of them are in elementary school this year. So I'll just mention one of the challenges, I think, for someone who is from a rural area who is raising kids in a city, is finding ways to make sure they are not in a bubble. Luckily, we do still have lots of family in rural areas in the state, including Rogersville. And so we get back there pretty often. But I just try to find ways to remind my children, like, this just remember, like, this is not how most of America lives. And
it's the exposure we just talked about.
It's like exposure. It absolutely is. I mean, I look at, you know, we're just coming to the end of summer. So every week has been some different phenomenally interesting summer camp that I would like to attend too, you know. But I contrast that with Hawkins County, you know, where I have two nephews who live there. And it's just such an amazing place. But you think about, like, there aren't a lot of summer camps, for example, for kids to attend there. And so, you know, the contrast in so many ways is still very stark. That doesn't mean one is better or worse necessarily. They're just very different experiences. And I think it's important for everyone to realize that we all do have very different experiences.
Absolutely. I'd agree. My daughter has attended a few of those amazing camps as well. But we're in rural West Tennessee, so we traveled. We had to, you know, take to the drop-off, and it might be 2 hours away. It might be, you know, 2.5 hours away. So, yeah, I agree. That's fantastic. Going back to your professional goals, though, I had to, you know, you talked about nerding out earlier. I have to nerd out a little bit as well because I'm in the IT field. And so when we talk about things like e-filing, paperless, or just any of these new projects that seem, I don't want to say out of reach, but they seem so large. They seem like a big undertaking. It's so fun for me to look at these projects and see them through the lens that you described, which is not we want to be the fanciest, or we want to just do this because it's new, or we want to advance for the sake of advancement. It's about access. You know, it's about offering an easier access through this e-filing. So that's really fascinating to me, to, you know, catch up these rural areas or even suburban areas that just haven't caught on to this yet, to say, hey, this is important, not just because it's something new. It's not just, you know, gosh, a piece of technology we have to spend money on. Like, because those seem to be a dime a dozen these days when it's like, oh, what are we buying now? Like, is this worth the investment? When you look at the investment as access, though, that is priceless. That is priceless. So that's very exciting.
That's such a good point, because I think sometimes we're quick to just rush to the new and shiny thing, but
that's right.
That, you know, I do think we have to be careful to make sure that whatever we're investing in, you know, as a state or as a county, you know, whatever we're investing in, you know, does it make sense for that particular place? And sometimes, you know, sometimes the new and shiny thing doesn't necessarily, or doesn't without some modification and without some tweaking. So I think with technology especially, you know, you hear the term change management.
That's
a
right.
lot. I've been hearing that a whole
That's
lot
right.
lately. But that is really important to, you know, you have to make sure it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And you really just have to make sure that you're bringing everyone along in that process and helping them understand, you know, why it makes sense and why it is actually going to help that particular place.
100%, because you need buy-in for that. You need that support, because with anything that big, you know, you talked about this will be obviously a project for years to come. You know, when you talk about a project and undertaking that large, you need the buy-in, because it will take 4 to 5 years to even get everyone comfortable with it. And then if it doesn't, if we haven't planned it out right, if we haven't picked the right, oh goodness, the right system of technology, it might take 4 or 5 more years to change to something else. And so it's really something that requires so much thought and so much buy-in from your stakeholders. So that's super exciting to think about, though. That's an undertaking here in Tennessee. You can sense, though, that just like in many other avenues, Tennessee is trying to be on the cusp of that, of access, of being there for rural citizens and things. So that's super exciting.
Well, and I'll just mention one other challenge with respect to, you know, our judicial system that rural counties face, and that is attorney recruitment.
Oh.
We see a lot of rural areas of the state that, you know, don't have enough attorneys. And so, you know, that's something I'm passionate about and something that I hope to work on in the coming years as well. And, you know, hopefully more opportunities for virtual work, that sort of thing will help that in some ways. But I think it's also, you know, helping graduates of Tennessee's law schools realize that there are great opportunities in our rural counties, you know, that you don't have to go to a big firm in Memphis or Nashville or Knoxville. You can have a very rewarding, both, you know, personally and financially, career in in our rural counties, and it's really important to get quality legal representation for folks in those places in our state. So I think there are, you know, different states have been approaching those or having the same challenges and are approaching that challenge in different ways. So I think we have a lot to learn there, but that's something that will be important to help our rural communities prosper.
I love that. I love that. As we mentioned off air, there is not a dedicated audience. We are speaking to the general public, but we also wanted to have some questions that could help our AIR students, those that are currently either in high school or in college or freshly graduated as they're trying to make their way through this career field that's so vastly different from when you and I started, you know, this post-COVID landscape kind of. But I would love to know, because if the people listening are not aware of your career, it is so aspiring to any young man or woman that would aspire to be in law. And so there's all these wonderful achievements that you have. What is your approach to decision-making, like guiding your team and leading? You know, how is that formulated over the years through your experiences at each shop level? What I'm sure you're not quick to make a decision, especially at this stage. So what is your approach to that?
Yeah, you're right that I tend to be a more contemplative decision maker. I think I'm not, I'm decisive, and, mm-hmm. and I think as a judge, I certainly have to be, but I don't think that means that every decision has to be a quick one. So, you know, I try to be very reflective and thoughtful when making a decision, whether it's a decision in a case that's before me or whether it's a decision about, you know, how to move forward with technology in our judicial mm-hmm. system. And I do wear, I think our Tennessee Supreme Court justices wear a lot of different hats. You know, we have our judicial decisions, but then, you know, we have a lot of other hats that we wear, you know, as we kind of regulate the legal profession and help lead the judicial system in Tennessee. So there are a lot of different kinds of decisions that I face, but I do try to be as reflective as I can. I'm very big on information gathering. I want to have all the information. Sometimes that can be a little debilitating, but I just want to know as much as I can about whatever, you know, whatever the decision is that's before me, whether it's a case, and I read everything and think about everything and talk about everything with my clerks, or, you know, if it's something about technology, for example, you know, I really try to get as much information as I can from stakeholders, from, you know, our judges and lawyers across the state, read as much as I can about what other places are doing and try to make sure that I know what all of our options are. And then at the end of that kind of information gathering process, I try to just be thoughtful about, you know, what are the goals? Mm-hmm. You know, so in addition to getting a law degree, I also got a master's in public policy.
I saw and, that. And was that at the same time?
It was at the same time. It was a dual degree. So it was 4 years instead of, I guess it would have otherwise taken 5 years, but it was great. But I've wondered for a long time, like, why did I get this master's of public policy degree? Because I never felt like I was really using it until now. And it's so fun to see how things work out in the longer plan. But I'm actually using those skills a lot now. Just take technology, for example. You know, a public policy analyst learns to identify your goals, and then you look at all your options that might help you achieve those goals, and you determine which option best meets those with all of these other considerations that go into that, for example, time and cost, feasibility, and stakeholder needs. So I actually have a pretty rigorous decision-making process, I guess, is to sum it up. A lot of information gathering and a lot of kind of matrix building to determine, you know, what are our goals and what's going to allow us to get there in the way we want to get there and need to get there.
I love that. It sounds like a very refined process that you've got down. I think we can all learn from that, because it's something I know I can think of a couple times where I've made a decision too fast and I'm like, if I could have just asked another person just a little bit more information gathering. And I because of those when I was younger, I can relate to what you said when you go, it's a little crippling sometimes, or it can be crippling sometimes, because you're like, I just don't know that we have enough information. And those, I think, are some of the hardest challenges you face, is when the information is just not available yet. You know, we're kind of like in this technology landscape we're in sometimes. It's just not available yet. Like, as we, you know, talk about the very controversial topic of AI, you know, as we look at what it can do, what it shouldn't do, what, you know, what we can utilize it for. It's one of those things where you're just trying to make the best decision with information available. But I do want to point out one thing that you said that was so, I think everyone listening should aspire to believe this with their full chest, when you said that you had a double master's and it was fun. Because I know a lot of people who have double majored who would not describe it as fun. So that is, I think, the best takeaway we can take.
I mean, I might have a unique view of fun, but... Quickly on the topic of AI, since you brought it up, I was just at a conference last weekend for judges about the topic of AI, of artificial, generative artificial intelligence specifically. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, that's an area where there's so much we don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think often when you have a lack of information, you know, that that could be a reason to put the brakes on a bit and, mm-hmm. and maybe not be the first to, you know, rush out and try to solve the problem, because we really, you know, we have to learn as much as we can and understand the risks, I think, before we take a lot of action on that. But that's an area that, of course, is getting so much attention now, including from, we have the Tennessee Bar Association has an AI task force that the judiciary will also have some members from the judiciary on that task force as we begin to think about this problem and try to get our hands around it to know, you know, what, if anything, we need to do as a profession as it becomes more prevalent in the practice of law.
And you are not the only profession that has to look into that, for sure.
No, not at all.
It is very large. What advice would you give, though, to young people aspiring to leadership roles, especially in... And we can take this as generic, like leadership roles in anything, but especially in areas like yours where you have been so successful throughout the years and, you know, not just taking advantage of these opportunities, but also, I mean, doing terrific work. What are your advice that you would give to young people about that?
So this advice may be a little more targeted to students in our rural counties, but since that's what I was.
I was going to say. I
guess that I like to speak to those students. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there can be some tension among rural students about how best to serve their communities. I think on the one hand, you know, you could do what I did, which is you leave. You go to college, you go on to graduate school, you go work in big cities. Maybe you eventually come back to the state, but, you know, I have never returned to a rural county to live, you know, since I left Hawkins County. And so, you know, that's one path. And I feel like now I'm in a position where, even though I don't live in a rural county, I really have opportunities to serve those communities. And I'm very grateful for that. You know, that's not always the case, that when you leave, you're going to, you know, have a position that so wonderfully allows you to still be serving those communities and thinking about those communities. But another option, of course, is to stay. And I can't tell the students who are currently facing that dilemma, which is going to be the best one for them. I think some students have really good reasons to stay. They have, you know, family members who are facing illnesses and they need help. You know, mm-hmm. they have, you know, maybe they help with childcare for family members. I mean, there are a host of reasons why it just may not be practically feasible for them to leave, but there are still wonderful opportunities, you know, with community colleges, with virtual education being more widely available now. You know, don't let your inability to go elsewhere hold you back, because you can still achieve really great things. And I think for the students who are leaving, and they may feel some guilt over that, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think that can be a hard thing for students who love their communities, but they feel like they need to get out to really to realize their full potential. It's okay to do that. I mean, it's important to do that. I think for so many students to live somewhere else, to see other places and to have other experiences, you might go back. Consider that, strongly consider that, that there may be, your path may eventually lead you back to the place that you left, or maybe that you wanted to leave. I mean, I should say not everyone feels this tension. I think some students can't wait to get out.
Right.
But your path may lead you back there, and that certainly doesn't mean you're a failure. I think I think sometimes we're equipped, you know, to go back and to really serve our communities and to make them better. And I think there are always ways that even those of us who don't eventually go back can serve our communities. I mentioned, I feel like I have a really unique opportunity to do that in my current position. But I think we all have the ability to do that, whether it's talking to a student from your home county who mm-hmm. is facing these decisions, or who maybe doesn't know, you know, anyone who is in a particular profession in his or her county, but they want to learn more about it. They want to decide whether that might be the right career path for them. You know, we need to have a really robust network of mentors for students in rural counties. You know, we have so many people who are in these communities who are able to do that, but I think it takes more than that. I think we really have to work together to give students in rural counties just as much access to information and to opportunities as students in other counties have.
And what you're saying now, too, is that you have the opportunity to be the exposure to younger students that you could have used in your youth as well. So, like, you get to be the exposure of, like, hi, like, I was once here, like, and I love here, and there's nothing wrong with here. But if you wanted to see what is out there, this is one of the options. This could be right. one of the career paths you could see. And I think it's really important. I think it's really great that you brought up, you know, that we're kind of level setting, that it's okay to stay, and there's opportunity to grow and advance there, that that's not a failure. I think at some point, there's a phenomenon called undermatching, where, you know, a student goes somewhere that they feel like they were better than, you know, and it doesn't mean that they couldn't capitalize on this, but it means that they, because of their own feelings of where they went, it impacted what they were able to get from that experience. And I do think that rural communities, virtual education, you know, the opportunities for just, I mean, even just high-speed internet, these career options that are opening, hopefully, are achieving what you're talking about, which is level setting and getting rid of this undermatching phenomenon to say, like, no, like, these are great opportunities, and you can leave, but you can also stay and have just as much of an impact that you want to have on this community. That is wonderful. That is wonderful. Jess Campbell, I cannot thank you enough for your time today and getting to be able to speak with you about this. It's wonderful to meet you.
Well, this was such a treat for me. Thank you for the invitation to join you today, and thank you for what you're doing to help rural students across the state. I'm a big fan of the Ayers Foundation and the work that the Ayers Foundation does in this area. So keep it up, and thank you for just highlighting the many wonderful things about our rural counties in Tennessee.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll get to hang out again in the East Tennessee County, one of those beautiful mountain places.
I hope so.
Thank you for tuning into Ten Talks. Ten Talks is recorded in the Ayers Audiovisual Studio located in the Ayers Entrepreneur Center in Parsons, Tennessee. You can find the Ayers Entrepreneur Center on Facebook, and you can also find out more about Ayers Foundation Trust at ayersfoundationtrust.org and facebook.com/AyersFSP.